Welcome to Consensus or Controversy, a special audio program focused on the management of prostate cancer that was developed from a satellite CME meeting held at the 2019 Genitourinary Cancer Symposium in San Francisco. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. This program features the perspectives of prostate cancer investigators on new strategies and controversies in the management of patients with prostate cancer. Our faculty for the meeting were Drs. Emmanuel Antonarakis, Oliver Sartor, Howard Scheer, Matthew Smith, and Cora Sternberg. Prior to the meeting, the faculty completed a survey documenting their recommendations for a variety of cases, questions, and other clinical and research issues. During the program, we discussed the results from the survey, and the faculty reviewed their rationale for their choices. The first module focused on the incorporation of androgen receptor antagonists into the management of patients with M0 prostate cancer. To begin, we posed the question whether PSA doubling time is the key factor in determining whether to initiate androgen deprivation therapy for a patient with non-metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer. I asked Dr. Smith why he considered PSA doubling time to be the most important factor in this decision.
Well, in a number of settings, PSA doubling time has been shown to be a powerful predictor of time to metastatic disease. And so for an individual patient, when you're considering benefit-risk, you have to consider what the expected natural history of the untreated disease would be. And so PSA doubling time turns out to be a relatively powerful predictor of that in both hormone-sensitive as well as in castration-resistant disease.
So Oliver, you, as always, provocative, and you put down here, no, it's not necessarily the most important factor. When you, again, see a patient, never had hormonal therapy, they have metastatic disease, hormone sensitive, what are the factors that you think of when you decide whether to initiate ADT?
Yeah, well, first of all, let me agree with Matthew that the most important prognostic factor is PSA doubling time, but the problem is that there's huge heterogeneity in our patients and their desires, their AIDS, their comorbidities, and their ability to sort of articulate why they do or do not want therapy. And, you know, there are some people who are adamantly opposed to the effects of ADT, and I really try to take patient preferences into account. Understanding the pathophysiology, understanding PSA doubling time is critical, but understanding the patient's position is critical too.
So the other situation, obviously, that's getting a lot of attention with new trials coming out is the patient who has disease progression on ADT, but still remains without metastatic disease, so M0. And we again asked, is doubling time the most important issue in this situation? Emmanuel, you said it is, but here you're more oriented around 10 months, you know, maybe a take on the phase 3 trials that landed on 10 months. But again, you have a patient who's been receiving ADT, now they have PSA progression. How are you going to decide whether or not you're going to consider adding something in?
So I think the point to make here, Neil, is that the PSA doubling time prognostic significance is different in the setting of rising PSA biochemical recurrence and here, which is the M0 CRPC. And so in this phase here, the data from Matthew Smith shows that a doubling time of 10 months above or below is the strongest prognostic indicator in those patients. So here I use 10 months or less, especially 6 months or less. There seems to be an inflection for the risk of metastasis at about 6 to 8 months.
So Cora, again, you have a patient who has progression, PSA progression, while they're receiving androgen deprivation. What are some of the factors that you said? Again, 10 months, doubling time is a key factor. Can you talk a little bit about how you approach these patients and decide whether or not to offer enzalutamide, apalutamide, maybe darolutamide now?
The 10 months, again, comes from the work from Matthew Smith, and from that we understood that anything less than 10 months is serious, anything less than 6 months is serious, and less than 3 months is even more serious. And based upon that, all of the clinical trials that we designed, the one with enzalutamide, the one with apalutamide, the one with darolutamide, were designed for patients. They're different criteria, but pretty much with patients have a doubling time of less than 10 months. So we don't have data of M0 CRPC of patients with more than 10 months. So based on the clinical trials, these are the patients that I would put on enzalutamide or apalutamide or darolutamide. In my case, I designed the trial with enzalutamide, and I have more experience with enzalutamide, so that would probably be my first choice, just based on my greater experience with enzalutamide, not saying that it's better or worse than the others.
So Howard, we put together a few questions that we asked to the audience, and it's starting to edge into this issue of what I'm going to call the numeracy of M0 prostate cancer.
and whether we can kind of come up with some guidelines about how you all are approaching it. So before we start to sort of dissect this out, Howard, I'm just kind of curious in general, is this a topic? You have a very educated patient, maybe your patient's a medical oncologist, very knowledgeable. Do you find patients who want numbers, or are they more just kind of looking to you and say, what should I do?
You see a mixture of both. There are some patients who come in with every article, every alternative medicine that can be found on the internet. Then we always have to be careful what else somebody's taking. We do have more advanced imaging techniques, which are starting to become more widely available. I know we'll be talking a little bit more about PSMA, but that's not the topic at this minute. I think you also have to look at the antecedent history. How's the patient tolerating ADT? So I hate to be pigeonholed into one, but clearly if the patient has a very rapidly rising doubling time, let's say he's had a relatively short course and short response, this is a patient who's not going to do well. Some of the older patients who have a longer antecedent history, I might be a little more discussion-oriented.
You know, there's one issue about what therapy you might recommend, but what I am going to see if I can pigeonhole you all into, but I'm not sure that I'm going to be able to, is the numbers that you would give them. So, Matt, let's just try to play out this one case and see if there are numbers that you can give me. So we asked the audience, okay, you've got a patient who's got a PSA of 14, doubling time to 3 months on ADT, and the audience says, if we don't do anything and keep on LHRH agonist, the chance of developing metastatic disease is extremely high, more than 70%. Agree or disagree, Matt?
Too high.
What would you say?
I'd say probably more in the 50% range.
Okay.
I think the key takeaway here is that PSA doubling time predicts a bad natural history of untreated disease. It also predicts a bad outcome despite intervention. And so I'd say the median time to progression in a patient like this is probably 2 or 3 years. And when he progresses, he's likely to have metastatic disease.
So just kind of curious then, if the patient said to you, okay, you're telling me I have a 50% chance, you know, roughly, very roughly, big broad range of developing clinical metastatic disease in the next few years, what would the risk be if I take, for example, enzalutamide or apalutamide, Matt? What number would you give?
That patient, his chance of progression for castrate-resistant disease, his right. chance of progression.
So you agree with the audience?
Absolutely.
So. Okay, yeah. Higher. And then how would that be altered, let's say 70%, by you, taking a drug like
you cut it in by half or more.
You cut it in half.
Can I just throw this in?
Yeah.
So, you know, when I'm in a situation where there's sort of a equal poise as to whether to treat now or later, I might actually start the questioning to the patient, like what probability would trigger you to want something done? So if I tell you there's a 20% chance, is that sufficient? If it's 90, it's pretty easy. So you think about what's the future event that you might be using the drug to prevent, and if you have an estimate of that probability, some patients want everything even if it's only 5%.
I'm just trying to figure out what the numbers are to start with, and not so much what the patient preferences are. And we actually asked the audience, okay, what do you think you would use in this situation? And you can see, interestingly, they're split between apalutamide, enzalutamide, and interestingly, abiraterone, which is an interesting thought. We also asked the audience, okay, same situation, but let's put cost and reimbursement issues aside. So now we would have the idea of apalutamide, which of course has not been approved, and you see a big bump in people who would want to do that. So Oliver, again, there's a huge absolute benefit here, you know, 30% chance. You're going to reduce the risk, at least temporarily. Any comments about your choice of therapy, Oliver?
Well, you know, first of all, we have really good data for apalutamide, darolutamide, and enzalutamide. And we have actually no good data for the abiraterone. But it's very reasonable to extrapolate, in my mind, the abiraterone into the space. So how do we choose if...
Could I just ask, though, if a patient came to see you as a second opinion, and the first opinion had recommended abiraterone, would you say, okay, that's fine, or would you say, I don't think that's the best choice?
Well, I would simply explain that we don't really have a lot of data, although we do have data in the castrate-sensitive disease and the castrate-resistant disease. It's kind of in between. There's every reason in my mind to believe that it would be quite active. One of the things that is different about abiraterone is that it's now generic. And the cost is going to drop dramatically, not dramatically now because we only have one generic, but as we end up with 2, 3, and 4 generics, there's going to be a plummeting of the price. And, you know, there's also the possibility, and I'm going to be a little bit of a provocateur here, of using something intermittently. And, you know, there's some patients who might or might not feel good about being on a drug forever, but if they respond well, they may want to try it and see.
So you're saying intermittent androgen agonists? Stop everything?
Yeah. Well,
or just
no,
the LHRH agonist?
No, you keep your LHRH going. I wouldn't go to the point now.
Oh, just intermittent?
Yeah, I've had patients absolutely positively in my practice who've been on intermittent enzalutamide in this setting. They go on it, and they don't really like the way they feel, but they have a really good response. And so what they do is they'll take the good response. They say, well, hey, Dr. Sartor, I want a little holiday. And I think that's permissible. I don't think it's wrong to do that.
Let's get down to the bottom line, though. In terms of you walk into clinic on Monday, you can prescribe any one of these four drugs. Any preferences, Oliver?
You know, right now, the firmest data, and I haven't really gone over the darolutamide as much, you know, the apalutamide and enzalutamide are the strongest. And enzalutamide we have a lot of experience with. So, you know, I know the drug supplies and everything, so I'd probably consider the apalutamide.
I just want to quickly, since it's so important, kind of take the pulse of the whole faculty. Cora, which of these four agents, if you could give them all, would you generally want to use in a patient like this?
I would give enzalutamide, knowing that we have like a 71% reduction in the chance of metastases. And I have the most experience at having used enzalutamide in post-chemotherapy, before chemotherapy. In this setting, I don't have any experience with intermittent enzalutamide.
Emmanuel?
Well, I like darolutamide. I've never used it, but the safety profile seems very favorable, and the lack of CNS effects and lack of falls and ataxia, which seems to not be there with this one, would be a major attractive factor for me.
So, Howard, any preference among the four?
No, we've had most experience with both APA and ENZA, so it's for me, it's pretty much a toss-up. I was intrigued, certainly, by the data presented in terms of the safety profile, but don't have any experience with it.
Matt, are you ready to use
that? I've experienced them with all, and they're all good choices, and I'm probably going to individualize treatment based on patient profile.
Individualized treatment, like what kind of factors other than, say, financial, other than that? Any clinical factors?
Yeah. Well, you know, Emmanuel already commented on these issues of tolerability, and, you know, we have to acknowledge that there are not head-to-head trials, which is what you would really need to be sure that there are differences. APA and ENZA are far more similar than different. Darolutamide does seem to be distinct in some ways that Emmanuel commented on, and that may be a distinct advantage for certain patients who are at particular risk for those side effects.
So it'll be really interesting to see how this plays out. I want to query you a little bit more about your own clinical experience, Matt, in terms of these drugs, because if I understand it correctly, the trials with apalutamide and enzalutamide, the difference in discontinuation of treatment, even though it was different, was only a few percent. So not that much data there to really hang your hat on. A lot of these things, the subjective fatigue, et cetera, you know, are a little bit harder to maybe characterize. Can you talk about your own clinical experience, Matt? Do you think you can see a difference?
I think yes. I mean, I have to qualify that by saying all of my experience with darolutamide to date has been in clinical trials that were placebo-controlled. And so there you have it, considerably more experience with apalutamide and enzalutamide. And my clinical experience is consistent with the reported clinical results, which is discontinuation of enzalutamide or apalutamide due to adverse effects of commercially available drug are low. But what I am impressed with in my own experience with darolutamide is during the placebo control part of the study, you couldn't tell which drug the patient was on.
And you think, could you when
in some cases, sure, you absolutely could.
I'm saying with the other drugs,
with
the other trials.
In some cases. But there are certainly patients who feel just fine, report no side effects with apalutamide and enzalutamide as well.
Howard, it's been really interesting to listen to people describe what patients describe to them. I try to get an understanding of what is this CNS thing, this fatigue thing that's going on. Can you talk a little bit more about what your patients say to you, what you observe clinically, Howard, in terms of these drugs, enzalutamide, apalutamide, in terms of this CNS effect?
Some people will say that they can't calculate things as quickly. There's a sense of cloudiness around them, can't concentrate to the same degree. That's also, in some cases, accompanied with fatigue, you know, which is the main incriminator, is hard. But there is a sense that the first person who really told me about this is pre-enzalutamide, was actually a litigator. He says, I'm not as sharp as I used to be. So it's really critical to get a handle on this more concretely. But there are, you know, in some cases, we'll reduce the dose.
Cora, anything else other than reducing the dose that helps? Any home remedies, complementary strategies, anything that helps these patients?
Well, one thing I'm thinking is that these patients are also on LHRH analogs, which could also perhaps be part of the reason that the lawyer wasn't as swift as he was before, because it's not just these drugs. I find that my patients have the biggest complaint is fatigue. I haven't really seen any of my patients really fall or have that problem. I'm not saying it doesn't occur. I think that it's really important that patients are put on an exercise regimen, and I tell them to walk fast 40 minutes three times a week or do something similar like swimming or anything that you like that's similar to that. And I put patients on a diet, which is usually a Mediterranean diet, and I try to keep, I think if they concentrated on taking care of themselves, on exercising, it gives them good endorphins, and I think it helps.
Okay, I'm going to try one more crack at this numeracy thing. Emmanuel, I want to see what you have to say. So we created this scenario of a lower risk situation than the first case. A patient who's on an LHRH agonist now has PSA progression. They're castrate insensitive. PSA level is 3.4. Doubling time is 10 months. So my question to the audience is, what would you say to this patient, the likelihood that they're going to have metastatic disease in, let's say, 3 years, and it looks like the audience is somewhere in the range of maybe 25 to 50%. Emmanuel, what kind of number would you give?
I think 50% is a reasonable guess.
50%, okay. And does that mean, and we asked the audience, how much of an absolute benefit? So if you buy 50%, then you would think the absolute benefit ought to be somewhere in the range of 25. We know it doesn't quite work out that well. Is that the math you would use, Emmanuel?
Yeah, I would say 20% if you used APA or ENZA.
And again, just kind of curious, are you treating patients like this? Because a lot of the audience isn't.
I mean, this one, I would be on the fence. His PSA is low. The absolute number is low at 3.4. The doubling time is right on the cusp. So I think this would be an individualized choice. But in my practice, I typically would not.
You would not. Cora, would you treat or not? And if so, with what?
I think that it would really depend upon the patient. This is a young man. He's 65. It would depend also on his comorbidities. He's not at very high risk. He's just right there on the 10-month where the curve starts to get worse. I would see how nervous he is and how much he wants to be treated and how motivated he is, too. I don't think there's a right or wrong answer here.
Although, you know, Emmanuel, you're saying there's a 25% chance this man is going to avoid having, at least for the time being, metastatic disease of 3 years by adding this in, but you would still observe him. Oliver, again, you agree with the numbers that you're hearing about this case, and what would you do?
General agreement on the numbers, and I would probably not trade in this individual. We have a little more time, we have a little more runway. He's not going to get in trouble anytime soon, and I would probably just defer treatment a little bit longer.
Howard?
We actually don't know what the optimal number is to compromise the response. So is it a difference if you treat that patient when it's 3.4 versus 20? We actually don't know that. So in some ways, I would tend to monitor this patient. But we do see some patients who are so concerned about it and just need something done for their own sanity.
So you're all saying observe, and Matt, correct me if I'm wrong, this patient would have been eligible for any of the three major phase 3
correct,
trials.
Correct, but he would have been the best patient on the trial because he had a low PSA, close to the cutoff of 2, and the slowest rate
of rise. So again, you think you might observe a patient like this?
I may, and they say that while all three of those studies included patients with a PSA doubling time of less than 10 months, the median all the trials was 4 to 5 months.
Oh, interesting. That's a good point.
The second thing I'd add is that you've made him a better prognosis patient by telling us he had a negative PSMA PET scan, so his risk for clinical progression would be lower than the average patient without that information.
Oliver, you were mentioning to me that, quote, the PSMA scan is almost always positive, so these people really have metastatic, I mean, we know they have disease.
I think you can take this non-metastatic space according to conventional imaging and then add molecular imaging and come up with a very different sort of conclusion. I think the vast majority of these individuals enrolled on all three trials would have had molecular imaging positive. Now, is there utility to using the molecular imaging? Is there a positive benefit? I'm not really sure yet. There's only one trial I'm aware of that's really looking at this space, and we have no data.
So, Cora, what about the older patient? When we asked the faculty, you know, it looks like a lot of people are kind of split between apalutamide and enzalutamide. Certainly the numbers look very similar. But what about the 80, the 85-year-old patient, Cora? Again, when you start thinking about the numbers, think about the adjuvant online model, for those of you who remember it. It actually factored in competing causes of mortality. Literally, it was one of the bars in adjuvant online. And it got to be 85, 90-year-old patient. It diluted out the benefit. Cora, can you talk a little bit about how you approach the older, the 80, 85-year-old patient with M0 disease?
I think that the 80 depends on 80, because there are 80s who are 70 and 60 and go horseback riding every day, and there are 80s who are 90. And so it really depends upon the person and their comorbidities and the other medicines that they're taking and what kind of health they're in. So I think just saying 80 alone without having that patient in front of me makes it very, very difficult for me to say, and I don't treat all 80s the same. So an 80 who's really feeble, I would be very scared to put on enzalutamide also, because I would be afraid of falls, for example, whereas I wouldn't be afraid in a 60-year-old.
So Oliver was bringing up the very intriguing thought of using intermittent androgen blockers, but keeping the LHA on. But Oliver, what about just using intermittent therapy, intermittent ADT, in prostate cancer, M0 disease, castrate-resistant M0 disease, and hormone-sensitive metastatic disease, or metastatic disease in general? Oliver, how do you use intermittent therapy?
The first division is the castrate-sensitive, castrate-resistant. I mean, that's really a key point. You know, certainly we use, in a lot of these patients, intermittent therapy for those with the castrate-sensitive disease, and this is supported by Laurie Klotz's article in New England Journal back in 2012, where you basically have similar outcomes. Moving into other settings, it becomes more of an uncertain situation. You know, Maha Hussain had published an intermittent for the metastatic population, and you know, there was a trend toward inferiority, but it crossed some confidence intervals that made it a confusing conclusion. That said, if you go to the castrate resistant, we actually have very little data to no data, and we want to continue the ADT in that situation. And the concept that I mentioned of using like an intermittent enzalutamide is something we've done in practice, because quite frankly, not everybody wants to be on these drugs continuously. They want to go on, they want to get the response, and they want to go off on it because they feel better when they're off of it.
So it's been really interesting having this little chat. I already have in my mind how I want to get 25 of you all and ask you like 150 scenarios like we've done, and see if I can kind of make sense of how you see these numbers.
In the next module, we focused on the management of patients with metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer. To begin, we asked the audience what they would recommend to a younger patient with widespread moderately symptomatic bone metastases, and interestingly, the most common answer was the combination of an LHRH agonist plus docetaxel. I asked Dr. Anton Arrakis if he observed symptom relief faster with chemotherapy compared to hormone therapy.
Well, you know, these patients typically start LHRH agonist for 4 to 6 weeks before they start either the ABI or the docetaxel. I would say no. The symptomatic relief can be very quick with abiraterone as well.
So what, in general, what do you think you would be thinking about in terms of adding to ADT, or would you hold off and just sort of see how the patient's doing?
This man has metastatic disease and he's got symptoms and he's got a Gleason 8. So I would typically give this person the choice of ADT plus docetaxel, which I think he could tolerate, or ADT plus abiraterone. I think there's strong evidence for both.
So sort of a coin flip. You can't really distinguish them. Matt, agree or disagree?
I would give him a third choice, which is doing both. We don't know that that's the right thing to do, but it's sure tempting to give him docetaxel and follow that with abiraterone acetate plus prednisone.
So you do that outside a trial setting?
Yeah, there is no such trial addressing that. Specifically, there is a trial that's addressing the combination of docetaxel plus AR-targeted therapy.
But you're saying you do it outside a trial setting?
Well, that trial's fully accrued, and there's no... outside of the clinical trial setting, I would consider that as a third option.
Howard, do you consider that as an option?
No, I tended to use abiraterone more in this setting, saving the docetaxel for later, and just looking... I don't think we know yet which patient has a tumor that's more sensitive to the docetaxel versus the hormonal part. You look at Mary Ellen Tapson's data in high-risk disease, she's getting some complete remissions with the addition of just abiraterone to standard ADT. So that's been a little bit of steroids in that situation, which you'll get with either arm. Doesn't hurt either.
So Oliver, we said, okay, you have the same situation, but now the patient's 80 years old. Now maybe you can talk a little bit again how you approach the younger patient with symptomatic disease and then the 80-year-old. The audience now is swinging much more towards abiraterone.
Yeah, and me too. I actually probably use abiraterone in the younger patient as well. And, you know, it's not that we necessarily have better outcomes. There's a stampede subset analysis that makes the OS look the same. so the survival looks the same for either one. And, you know, from my perspective, you have this febrile neutropenia, and you also have some pretty substantial morbidity. But I think the real reason I do it is Kim Chi's paper, which really showed an improvement in quality of life in the Latitude study, as opposed to the change in charted, which Alicia Morgan's reported. And I was more impressed with the Kim Chi data out of Latitude. So I think quality of life-wise, I think you're going to do a little bit better with abiraterone.
When we asked what the faculty said about these two questions, there's a little bit of a difference about how people approach it. You know, a lot of people feel reassurance when they see that there's a spectrum of what investigators do, because maybe there's not a clear-cut answer, and that can translate into clinical practice. It's interesting, Matt, we actually asked you all, we said a patient like this has seen another doc who's recommended, maybe they saw you, Matt, docetaxel and abiraterone. Now they're coming to you. Would you say that's a good idea? Would you say that's a bad idea? Would you say, well, that's an okay idea? But it's not what I would do. And you can see that a couple of people, including
well, I didn't disagree with myself. The difference here is I think what you're proposing is concurrent therapy, which I would not
recommend. Oh, you're talking about sequential.
I talked about sequential. So
All right. Well, that's an important point. So it's kind of abiraterone maintenance you're talking about then, right?
Call it what you want. But I guess what I'd say is I like abiraterone as part of metastatic hormone-sensitive disease, and I was just adding the wrinkle to Emmanuel's comment, which is, I say, the consideration is whether you would, in certain patients, begin with 6 months of docetaxel.
Interesting. So, Cora, one of the answers that some of the audience have given, and we see this every time we ask these kinds of questions, is that I'm going to start ADT and see how the patient does, and then if they, quote, don't respond as well as I want them to, then I'll add something in. Is that something you ever do?
That's something we did in the past, and it's not something that we do now any longer. I think it maybe is something you could do if someone is a really sick 80-year-old and you're afraid to add too many things. You know, it depends upon their comorbidities and how many other medications they're taking. But as an idea, I think from the data that we have now, the combination either with docetaxel or with abiraterone is a much better choice in terms of long-term survival and adding years onto their life if they can take one of those therapies.
So, Emmanuel, we put this case together because, you know, initially when the first charted data came out, there was a subset of lower volume, smaller number of mets that didn't, quote, seem to benefit. But it looks like now when we present this case to the audience, you don't see very many people not treating, even though they're only three rib mets. How do you approach patients who are asymptomatic, Emmanuel, and have, you know, minimal volume disease? Are there situations in a younger patient like this where you're just going to use an LHRH agonist, or pretty much all of them are going to have something added onto it?
So first of all, between docetaxel and abiraterone, in this case, I would lean strongly towards the abiraterone. In my opinion, the data is not as strong that in the low-volume disease, docetaxel early adds a benefit. And then the second question about de-escalating therapy and forgetting about the abi altogether, I would do that in certain occasions, especially if I was planning to target the metastases with a radiotherapy or some other metastasis-directed approach. I may give less ADT and try to treat the mets.
Any thoughts? You see 15% of the audience is saying enzalutamide now in this situation. Emmanuel, any thoughts about how that's going to factor in, for example, in contrast to abiraterone?
Yeah, I mean, I was less impressed with that data because the OS was not predefined as a co-primary endpoint, and the primary endpoint as designed was met, which was RPFS. But if we have two other choices that do extend overall survival and one that we don't know if it does or not, I probably wouldn't use ENZA in that setting.
Howard, would you like to do a counterpoint to that? What did you think about the data? Is that a strategy you think you might want to start thinking about?
I think the data is reasonable. There's enough experience across pretty much the whole spectrum of the disease, and they're all pretty similar. One of the things I just following up on what Emmanuel mentioned, this is a patient that, you know, you might consider adding radiation therapy to the rib lesions at some point. And we actually have a formal protocol now that's asking that question. If you rarely see complete elimination of disease in bone.
So you're saying radiating asymptomatic bone mets?
We would treat this patient with a combination of hormones and SBRT to the lesions that are visible as a possible elimination of disease strategy. We're trying to shift the equation from let's wait till something happens as opposed to let's see if we can get rid of everything.
I've not heard that one. Oliver, what do you think about that idea?
Well, there are two elements here for radiation, and one of them I did want to expand on because I don't think we touch on it. So the STAMPEDE trial looked at a low-volume subset defined by charted radiated the prostate and came out better on overall survival. That was published in Lancet, presented at ESMO. So there's definitely a potential role. Now, this patient would not have fit low-volume charted, so it's outside the axial skeleton. So this would not have been...
Three rib mets wouldn't have fit the low-volume thing. Wow.
This would actually not have been a low-volume by charted definition. But there is a low-volume here, and I think what Howard's saying is very reasonable. You know, first of all, you might want to radiate the prostate, and then you may want to come back and use metastasis-directed therapy to take out three little rib lesions. And then that way you've radiated everything, and then plus you've got your ADT abiraterone on board. I think some of these patients can go on for a long time.
Yeah. So I don't want to get too far off on the tangent, but yeah. I'm just kind of curious. Matt, do you radiate the prostate in patients with metastatic disease a la STAMPEDE?
Yeah, we have data supporting that, and Howard didn't comment specifically if he'd included the prostate in his in the radiation part of the radiation treatment. Two thoughts on this one is one, I mean, I'm accepting that these are three rib metastases, but rib lesions are notoriously false positive, and I'd worry about that a little bit. And the other thing is this construct of high volume, low volume. What we really are thinking about is this patient's cancer-specific mortality. This is a young, presumably healthy guy. He has very little competing risk. He's destined to die of prostate cancer. And I think we need to include that as part of the treatment plan.
Let me clarify on our program is for the newly diagnosed patient with low volume metastatic disease. It includes integration of surgery, which is removal of the primary tumor, pelvic lymph nodes, and in selected cases, we're actually doing RPLNDs, and with a radiation to visible lesions by bone scan to a maximum of 3 isocenters.
So just real quickly, Oliver, I'm going to run through a couple more scenarios. Liver mets, Oliver, again, in the hormone-sensitive situation. The audience seems much more oriented towards chemo, docetaxel. Agree or disagree, Oliver?
Disagree, and I don't think the data justify.
And you see that there's, again, a little bit of a spectrum of how the faculty responds to that situation in terms of liver mets. One other question I was just kind of curious about, Cora, maybe you can comment on it. In this decision about whether to add, for example, abiraterone and now enzalutamide, but we asked the audience about abiraterone, how much toxicity is add? As it is, the patient's going to get started on ADT. So that's a whole new way of life for people. But then the question is, how much more toxicity are you adding by bringing in, for example, abiraterone? A lot of the audience thinks that it doesn't really add that much more on top of ADT. What do you think, Cora?
I don't think it adds in a lot more toxicity. The toxicity has to do with long-term being on corticosteroids in the long run. But when we did the original abiraterone studies, I mean, we didn't really know if patients were on abiraterone or they weren't on abiraterone, and they would either live or die, and that's how we knew. This was patients post-chemotherapy. So I don't think abiraterone in and of itself is very toxic. There are those few patients that have some cardiac problems. But as an idea, it's not a toxic drug. What's more toxic is the corticosteroids on the long run.
In the third module, we focused on the management of patients with metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer. To begin, we posed the case situation of a patient who developed castrate-resistant disease and asymptomatic bone mets while receiving ADT. The audience was split between using enzalutamide, abiraterone, and cipuleucel-T, and I asked Dr. Scherer about his recommendation.
Well, in general, we generally are starting a second hormone as the first treatment. Again, you have a clear objective response. You have phase 3 data that it works. And again, frankly, we haven't used much cipuleucel-T at Sloan Kettering.
So, Emmanuel, this would be sort of the classic CIP-T situation. Are you using it?
Yes, I don't use it that much, but if I do, this would be the case.
The audience, there's a kind of a split between using hormones or CIP-T, but much more towards the use of hormones. But Emmanuel, we asked this situation. Now you have a patient, same situation, the patient's getting ADT for M0 disease, and now it's found to have widespread, moderately symptomatic bone mets. And again, you see the audience, once you start talking about symptoms in a younger patient, swinging toward docetaxel in this situation. How do you think it through, Emmanuel?
It all depends how long they were on ADT before they became castration resistant. So if it took them 5 or 6 years to become CRPC, I think that person would respond to abiraterone. If they became castration resistant in 6 months after starting ADT, that patient, I would probably choose docetaxel.
And you can see that, in general, the faculty is more oriented towards the use of hormones in this situation rather than chemotherapy. Oliver, how do you think through this situation? Why are you going with abiraterone, where the audience is more going for docetaxel?
It's kind of interesting. The abiraterone data is really strong, and I find it's better tolerated, and it's something that we've been able to use in our clinic without any real side effect profile issues. Docetaxel has the febrile neutropenia, of course, and I've been using abiraterone, and I've been pretty pleased with it in that situation, supported by a variety of data, although you could exclude the 302 data simply because it was asymptomatic. But I have no trouble using it in this setting.
So, Oliver, I asked you before about liver mets, and here's another situation with liver mets. Now, again, the same situation, first diagnosis of castrate-resistant disease. Again, the audience much swinging toward docetaxel. Docetaxel or hormones, Oliver?
I'm fine either way. First of all, you know, if there's the opportunity for molecular profiling, I think it'd be terrific to be able to add that in. We haven't talked about molecular profiling at all, and that is, you know, the liver mets, I think, are more likely to have something on the neuroendocrine phenotype. We're understanding and dissecting those genetic changes today, and it could change my mind, you know, particularly if you've got a biallelic BRCA, you know, that's a little bit of a separate situation where something like a platinum ought to be used, at least in my opinion. So as we move forward in time, I think we have to add in the profiling for the molecular status. And right now, on the basis of the data, I'm fine with either taxane or abiraterone, or enzalutamide, for that matter.
Howard, we asked about the situation where the patient has metastatic disease to the bone, but they're asymptomatic. They respond to abiraterone, but then start to have PSA progression. A lot of the audience, if the patient was symptomatic, would continue the abiraterone in spite of the PSA increasing. But 21% would test for ARV7, Howard. How do you think through the situation of a patient who's progressing on abiraterone and enzalutamide, and particularly are you using ARV7?
Well, the first question is, what is the real progression? Patients had an initial response. Let's say the PSA was first diagnosed in the range of 100, and now it's gone down to 5 or 1, and it's rising very, very slowly. This is a patient we would continue to monitor. This was a real problem in many of the early protocols because we were mandated, if they hit the milestone of PSA progression, however it was defined, we were mandated to stop treatment. And we worked through this very carefully as a community, the prostate cancer research community, in the working group 2 guidelines, which says that you have the option to monitor a patient when the PSA is rising. And, you know, several patients of mine with our early abiraterone experience did not show signs of overt progression for upwards of 2 or 3 years. So this is not trivial. In a patient who is, let's say, having real progression, we really can't predict if they will respond to a second hormone or not. And this is the place where there actually now is a formal test that is covered by CMS, which is to test for ARV7. There are a number of different assays out there. In some cases, individuals will go directly to chemotherapy, which I would say is not wrong. But there is data now where you can show that the result of the ARV7 test is used. You can identify patients who will not respond to the second hormonal agent, who should be getting a taxane, and that's been shown to impact on survival.
Oliver, ever the creative thinker, I was very curious when I saw this answer, high-dose testosterone.
Well, you know, the Hopkins guys have influenced me. They've infiltrated into my brain, and now I'm starting to echo what they say. And, you know, the thing that's been absolutely amazing to me, this high-dose testosterone, which I initially saw it, I thought was absolutely crazy. It must have been the stupidest idea that somebody had a nightmare about and tried to decide to bring into clinical trial. I have been amazingly impressed in this situation with where we've used it on trial. We were part of the Transformer trial, which Hopkins led, Hopkins initiated. We joined in, put a few patients on. We're now actually using it off trial. And some of these patients are having really pretty astounding responses, and they feel good.
What's the actual agent and the dose?
What I'm using is the same thing that the Hopkins guys, with a little variation. So it's 400 milligrams of testosterone cypionate IM. Now, they've been using pretty consistently Q4 weeks, and I've shortened it up to Q3 for a reason that I could talk about with Emmanuel. But also, there's also the transdermal patch, which you can use and just take the T up to about 1,000 and keep it there.
Yes.
You probably know that at one point, a long time ago, high-dose estrogens were used to treat metastatic breast cancer. So is that kind of the same idea?
Same.
You know, it is a precedent, and that came and went, but it was very, very important in the old era to add in high-dose estrogen. The problem there were the clots. You know, because you do have an estrogenic activity leading to DVTs,
thrombosis, et cetera.
And that was problematic. With the high-dose T, we have not seen clots. And in fact, the side effect profile is remarkably good. Most people feel better.
No clinical flares?
Yes, it's certainly possible. But what we've tried to do is to pick the patient who is relatively asymptomatic, relatively low volume, I say have a little runway to have an opportunity that even if they get worse, that they're not going to suffer any clinical harm. And I really would be interested in hearing from Emmanuel if that's proper for me to ask.
Absolutely.
Because these guys have more experience than I do.
And also, Emmanuel,
and they've been the leaders.
There's a drug that's an impeded androgen that was used in breast cancer. Has that been tried in prostate cancer?
I don't think so. I'm not aware. I would just say that I would strongly discourage high-dose testosterone in the community. About one-third of patients have a dramatic and durable response. We do not know who those patients are. About one-third have no benefit, and about 20% you accelerate the disease, which can be very scary. So please don't do this at home yet.
That's a really great point. We showed that Howard, you, and Emmanuel are using the ARV7 assay. We asked the audience, and two-thirds said they don't think there's enough data to use it. When we asked you all, actually you were kind of split, and I guess Oliver joined in thinking there's enough data. One other thing we asked you to touch on, and you know, this is coming up, pancreatic cancer, ovarian, you name it, MSI high disease. So we asked the faculty, are you doing MSI testing in metastatic prostate cancer? And you can see the answer is uniformly yes. Interestingly, multiplex genomic testing, and Emmanuel, when we get to your section on BRCA and PARP inhibitors, we'll talk a little bit about whether or not somatic assays like NGS can be helpful and identifying patients who might benefit from PARP inhibitors.
In the fourth module, we discussed the use of PARP inhibitors in the management of patients with prostate cancer. To begin, we asked the audience whether or not they're recommending BRCA germline testing for patients with metastatic prostate cancer, and about three-quarters of the audience said they would. The faculty in general agreed, and I asked Dr. Sternberg to comment on her approach.
I think the problem is that there aren't enough genetic counselors in the world who are absolutely capable of doing this, and we need more genetic counselors who are aware of the problem. But when I've had patients that are BRCA2, even in Italy, and I had the whole family tested, I had them tested, and they spoke to a genetic counselor before they went for the testing. They spoke to me before they went to the testing. They understood what they were getting themselves into with the testing, what it could mean. But I think it's a combination. But I think one of the problems is that there aren't enough genetic counselors.
So Howard, Eileen O'Reilly from your place, she said in some parts of Memorial, and I'm curious whether it's getting in the GU, they're showing patients a video that, you know, in the waiting room on an iPad, so they don't go to a genetic counselor unless they have a family history, but if they're getting the test for therapeutic purposes, they look at the video. I thought that made a lot of sense. Well, are you doing that too?
The consenting for the MSK impact includes two parts. The first is for the sequencing for looking for somatic alterations. Part two, which is a separate consent, is for the germline. That is done by video, which essentially ensures that patients are getting consistent information about the test. An important finding from the germline analysis is that the family history alone is insufficient to identify patients who have significant risk. So we have worked out several algorithms in order to screen which patients actually need a full genetic counselor. Obviously, we've had staff, but I think this is a real issue. And there have been a number of collaborative efforts now through the Prostate Cancer Consortium to make sure that these are handled appropriately.
There is a lot of debate, I hear, in ovarian cancer about whether to start out with germline testing or somatic testing and then reflex back into germline. Oliver, can you just kind of give the doc in practice some practical guidance? You have a younger patient who's running out of options in terms of testing. So just BRCA germline, germline panel, what about NGS, somatic testing, and general community practice right now?
So I think the data really are quite strong now for the use of germline testing. We use a panel approach. in those with metastatic disease, and we test every single patient. Now, the somatic is a little more complicated because at times you may have old biopsies or old radical prostatectomies from 20 years ago. We've been using a lot of circulating tumor DNA. I don't know how good it is, but I do know that we now have an MSI readout, and in that setting, plus we can pick up BRCA. We're missing the deletions. I know that for a fact. So things like RB, we're going to be missing even if it's deleted. But what I'll say is that we're trying to profile these patients, and we're learning about the application in terms of therapy. I feel like we have a lot more to learn. But I think with the BRCA1, BRCA2, we have pretty good PARP data. But don't forget about platinum, please, because platinum is quite active in this setting.
That's a great point. And Howard, we were doing a symposium and Rob Dreiser was there and he brought up the issue of liquid biopsies looking for PARP. And Oliver just referred to it. What do you get out of liquid biopsies in terms of BRCA, Howard? Is it worth doing?
In some cases it can be detected, but again, you have to be very careful in terms of the assay because there is a marked amount of inconsistency in the field. And this is still a real problem. If you actually look at the number of publications on cell-free DNA, they are innumerable. But right now, the only real approved tests are for mutations for which there are clearly actionable drugs. So again, you can get this information. Emmanuel, remember a study I mentioned earlier, took this essentially the same sample and sent it to two very large laboratories and got different results. So again, there are now cell-free groups that have formal FDA approval, and I would be very careful about making sure that you're going to a group that has that level of endorsement.
So a couple other questions we asked the audience. Would you prescribe a PARP inhibitor to a patient with a BRCA germline mutation? 90% of the audience says either they've already done it or they would do it. But we also asked, what about the patient with a somatic BRCA mutation? 70% of the audience said either they've done it or they would do it. When we ask you all, we also ask about ATM germline mutations, and you can see in general. You know, I think a couple of years ago here at ASCO GU, I had a panel up here before this all started. I don't know what prompted me to just say, are you doing BRCA testing? And one person, I think you were there, Oliver, one person said yes, and I'm like, really? And then I asked the other five, and they all said yes. And then I said, have you all used PARP inhibitors? And every single one said yes. So now it's really playing out, I think, in practice.
In the last module, we talked about bone-targeted therapy and emerging radiopharmaceuticals. We asked the audience if, based on the data and their own clinical experience, they believe radium-223 relieves pain. The vast majority of the audience and most of the faculty said yes, and I asked Dr. Sternberg if she treated patients with metastatic prostate cancer who had a relief of bone pain with radium-223.
I would say absolutely that I've observed patients with improvement in bone pain. I think that radium-223 is a very good drug. The main problem that I've had is if we give it to patients very far along with a lot of bone mets, that I've had problems with cytopenias afterwards, and then if I even find a BRCA mutation, I can't give them a PARP inhibitor.
Yeah, we actually asked the audience about this issue of cytopenias, and they seem to think that it's either occasional or maybe a little more common than that. When we asked the faculty, they kind of gave the same answer. It sounds, Oliver, like you can see it, not that common. How much of a problem are cytopenias with radium-223, Oliver?
You know, my experience is really related to the volume of the disease, and when you have these very high-volume diseases, you're more prone to see it. And there is, of course, the marrow infiltration that occurs with progression of the cancer, with progressive anemia and cytopenias. Sometimes it's a little bit hard to figure out. We've done marrows on patients who've had severe cytopenias, and every single time we find marrow infiltration with cancer. So
wow.
There can be some confounding factors.
Interesting. That's really a great point clinically. You know, when I first started hearing about radium-223, as the story started to evolve, you know, I've been trying to figure out the last few years, like, where it's indicated. And then the last year or two, I was starting to think, oh, it makes a lot of sense to add it to enzalutamide or abiraterone. And obviously, you all are not doing that. I don't think investigators are doing it in general. I was trying to like kind of focus in on what would be a clinical situation where you'd use radium-223. And so we created this scenario of a younger patient, symptomatic disease, who had disease progression of enzalutamide, abiraterone, and docetaxel. And Matt, the audience was kind of split between radium-223 or cabazitaxel, more chemotherapy in a patient like that. Maybe it would make a difference to you in terms of when they came off docetaxel for example, Matt, but in general, how do you manage patients like this once they get beyond the three key drugs?
Yeah, my impression is that cabazitaxel has a greater potential to modify the course of the disease. So in a patient who's a reasonable candidate for such treatment, I would favor cabazitaxel.
So I was also curious, we asked the audience, suppose the patient was 80, and as you might guess, they swung more towards radium in the older patient than chemotherapy. One other thing I was curious about, Oliver, how many times, if at all, they've used lutetium-177, and it looks like most of the audience is not, as you might imagine, but there certainly seems to be a lot of interest, and actually even in this audience, a little bit of experience with that really exciting therapy.
The next topic we discussed was the use of the prostate-specific membrane antigen, or PSMA-binding ligands, to target tumors regardless of their location. A Phase 2 prospective study evaluating PSMA lutetium for PSMA-positive patients with metastatic castrate-resistant prostate cancer and progressive disease after standard treatments reported a PSA decline of greater than 50% in 57% of patients, and a median overall survival of 13.5 months. I asked Dr. Sartor if he thought this agent elicits clinically meaningful responses and if he would like to have access to it right now.
I'd love to have it available now, and a lot of patients are being referred, particularly over to Germany, Australia. I think I heard the answer yes from Howard, so yeah. Let me let him elaborate.
Again, PSMA was actually cloned at Memorial Hospital, and we've been looking at this as a target for therapy in many different ways. In addition to radiation, it's being used as an immune targeting, as well as delivery of cytotoxics. The criteria that are used primarily for the Germany, and that's where we've been referring patients, is to have a certain threshold level of uptake of the tracer on an SUV, on a dedicated PET scan. We originally started working with J591. This was a whole antibody that was developed by Neil Bander at Cornell. Then we worked with a minibody. They tend to circulate for multiple days within the circulation, so the radiation exposure is much higher off target. Whereas with the small molecules that are now being used, you basically give it, it's out, and it's there. You have the dwell time localized to the tumor itself. So the patient selection, if they haven't been really heavily pretreated, we've seen very dramatic responses. And they're now looking at the non-castrate population as well as a way to avoid hormones, using hormones to, if you think about PSMA levels, it goes the inverse of PSA. Castrate someone, PSMA levels go up. So that's a potential way to get more isotope delivered to the place where it's needed.
Just out of curiosity, this might be a naive question, Matt, but what about CAR-T focusing on PSMA and antibody-drug conjugates focused on PSMA?
So antibody-drug conjugates have been used. We used, actually going back into the early 2000s, but the linker of the toxin was not sufficient. There was another one that was developed also using a tubulin targeting agent. We actually did see some responses, and there is activity. It's just a question of, can we identify the patient ahead of time in order to take that development strategy through with an effective safety profile?
Matt, we're talking with your lymphoma people all the time about CAR-T. Has CAR-T been used in prostate?
There's ongoing studies, and there are other immune approaches, including bispecific antibodies targeting PSMA.
Yeah, those are really exciting.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Consensus or Controversy, a special CME program focused on the management of prostate cancer.